Yeah, maybe council can come back with some nice language.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd ask Eric to just run that past someone like Jeanette Holtman, who's been working with this chapter rather extensively.
Because I don't claim to be an expert in this.
Yeah, and make sure that we get what we think we're getting when we use these words, and I think that's fine.
What chapter are you looking in?
Well, it's in, it's the hazardous substance. It's the same references in here. It's 43, 453, 005, but there's some other. Just need to check with Jeanette, who's done most of the drafting on with the environmental, with the Superfund bill and all of those kinds of things.
Okay.
Now let's go to a different part of this thing. Now I think that, from my point of view, somebody's gonna, you're gonna have to get your thinking caps on here to figure out something else. I'm just really not prepared to move from 10% level to the 20% level unless we make some other changes in here, and I would be willing to consider raising that up. My preference, of course, would be, well, if we wanted to, if you want to make this percentage level, whatever the committee agrees on, if it's more than 10%, if you want to do that, then I'm going to suggest to you that you take a hard look at making that percentage apply across the board to all damages, economic and non-economic damages alike. I don't think I, well, maybe if I'm the only one that's concerned about going 20%, why, I'll have to rethink my position, but I
think you'll find folks who are concerned about going 20%. It's a question mm-hmm. of what else, you know, what's the price of going to 20%?
Yeah. Well, that's what we ought to be thinking about, yeah. Because, and I offer that
15%
as,
or whatever.
Yeah, I offer that as a possibility. Anybody else have any comments on this before we move on?
I'm sure it'll be an issue we'll revisit.
Okay. Announcement, there's a pizza in the office in case anyone is interested. Okay, now we'll take a look at page 10. And
Mr. Chair, maybe yeah. Before we leave that subject, I know we've talked about some amendments. I may as well distribute one that I asked to sort of be prepared in a rough fashion. This takes us back a little bit further to the work and the recommendation for discussion before the task force, but may as well lay it on the table here so folks will have a chance to perhaps look at it over the evening. I believe this is based upon a model recommendation. Council may recognize it.
Isn't this in the form of an amendment at different times?
Maybe.
I'm not sure if it was ever discussed before the House Committee or the
this
Senate Committee.
Looks awfully yeah. familiar to language that was in seven or in section 14 of the original task force bill.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Well, I don't need further discussion now, but I just share that with folks before we leave this section.
Well, let's put, just so we can identify it and reference, and let's just put Springer's name on it.
That'd be fine.
Okay, let's, here, can you pass those down there, would you please? Just, you can... Put my name on this one, this is a suggestion I'll offer up. further on this in a moment? Okay, on page 10, I much prefer, it would be my intention when the time comes to move the substitution of section 12 of the C engross bill for section 8 of the D engross bill.
Senator Fry, when it comes time to motions, I would be looking heavily towards the D engrossed with the one change on line 30, writing in the word is voidable rather than void, with reference to fee agreements.
What was that again now?
Well, you raised the issue on our last discussion, yeah. Line 30, that using the word void right. rather than voidable, and I would just expressed intention of moving the section with the word voidable rather than void. I'm recognizing that doesn't alleviate all your concerns with the section as you raised.
Yeah, subsection 1A of your version is already ours, so I assume that there's not going to be any disagreement with that part. And I suppose...
I don't know, Mr. Chair, I see yes. down there in sub B, when we ask the state bar to prepare something in plain and simple language, I'm not sure that's something
that's
they're capable of doing.
Okay. Well, I think, is it fair to say that section 12 and section 8, subsection 1, A are essentially the same. So I guess we've agreed that language ought to be in there somewhere, right? So it's a question of B and C and subsections 2 and 3 that we have to kind of get with here. And I suppose it's being offered up, or was offered up in the House bill, just because it sounded like good public policy to kind of put some guidelines on attorney fee agreements. When we all know that at least this part of the bill doesn't have anything to do with the matter of insurance, right?
Well, I'm willing to agree that it doesn't have anything, it doesn't reference insurance specifically, but...
Any comments anybody wants to make further on this? All right. Now, on page 11... collateral sources. Counsel,
First let me point out that Senator Cohen had asked for the language of the original bill, and so you'll find in your notebooks pages 11A and 11B. 11A is the language of the task force report, the original 323, along with some commentary that we prepared for the committee, and 11B is the language that we had arrived at before deleting the whole thing.
Right. That's probably what we ought to look at.
Which is, I assume, what Senator Cohen wanted.
Yeah. So it's 11B?
That's correct, Senator.
I'm sort of missing all those pages, but that's okay.
Counsel?
Go ahead.
What was our language in the Norwood report?
Pardon?
The minority report,
I'm afraid I can't. Eric, what our language was in the minority report.
Considering the way this language is drafted on page 11, it might well be your language.
Yeah, it might be.
You're referencing its great form and style and brilliance, I'm sure.
It might be.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I don't
This is one of the ones that I was surprised by the strong reaction of the judges in, the circuit court judges in my district. I mean, I didn't believe that we had, I thought it was something that we had, we around this, in general, this body decided it was something that probably was generally taken care of as long as you didn't include some of the other, you know, the broader personal benefits that people had been had purchased. The call I got from my local judge was more the time it would take in dealing with the court cases, and that it was I was just surprised by the fact that you'd have to have a separate hearing and that it would take some extra time and stronger than I would have anticipated.
Fits in with two or three other things the House did that prolongs litigation, drives insurance costs up.
No, I wouldn't go that far, but I was going to say that's the strongest reaction I've gotten from anybody who read both versions and who had read some of the others. I was surprised by his comments, and he was a relatively conservative Republican judge before he got to be a judge.
We struggled with this crazy issue in the task force and beat the deck, because I guess we gave up in the Senate because we didn't think it was really worth all the trouble, but now here it is in the House version. Paul, would you have a comment you want to make?
Well, maybe your conservative judge would have been happier if we said he shall deduct it and force them to do it and took away all the decision-making process, and perhaps the fact that he had to make a decision on this stuff bothered him a little bit. I think I know what judge you're referencing, but it was a debated item, and there was a lot of heat generated on this section from that side that said they shall be deducted, and versus the others of us who I think Representative Dix and I felt similar on this issue, giving them the option and giving them some deduction, some issues to deal with. I haven't had a chance to look at your other language though, so I'm not really prepared to comment on it.
The easiest sense of it's just, I guess.
See, we have a shall deduct.
Yeah.
Where's the amendment? You got it?
Yeah.
All right.
What was, Joyce, did you have a, what was your last comment?
Actually, in fact, the last three, what, I'm sorry, did you hear
you? What, you just said something.
I said, in fact, the ones that we considered in rejected on the Senate side had a shall deduct.
That was the major. Once we decided to have a collateral source section, which was not an easy, this was not easy to get to that decision, we then argued over may and shall. And it's funny, I mean, for six months, sometimes judges come in and they want may, and sometimes they want shall, and usually it's whatever benefits them. In this case, I was concerned about the individual and giving the judge discretion to look at that on behalf of the insurance companies, who argue that there shouldn't be a tremendous windfall, but at the same time give the judge the discretion to look at it. If it's a small policy, perhaps it's not worth his time. If the person's getting $1.5 million in disability benefits, that's another story altogether.
Well, if we end up agreeing with the House that we should have a section on collateral estoppel, collateral source, I'm going to suggest that maybe this could be a little better written than it is, and I've already submitted to counsel, who now has it down LC, a rewrite, which doesn't change the substance of the House version here, but I think it just dresses up the language a bit. So if we have to come to that point, I'm at least going to respectfully ask that you consider a different way of expressing that thought. Dick, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I guess I certainly agree with the position of the House in terms of making this discretionary. And I feel comfortable so doing. I would feel a little more comfortable if we could tie into the definition or the benefits to which these apply if we were to track more closely with the recommendation of the task force or that which was apparently considered at one time by the Senate. I don't know if that's addressed in your amendment, but I
know
we can reserve further discussion of that, I guess, at the time when we consider other amendments.
What is it, Dick, on page 11A there, what particular language are you looking at, if any?
Well, on 11A, I'm looking at the definitions on lines 26 through 31, which I think are probably come closer to what I feel ought to be the definition than that which we adopted in the House version.
Well, is there anything in there that's not covered in the House version?
Well, if I think you compare the definition in the House past the sub 3 there on lines 4 through 6, page 11, I think you will find a difference, and I just feel more comfortable with the recommendation of the task force.
Okay, well, let's see. Now...
it's this room.
Pages. Page 12. Now I'm just not going to vote for any license to kill. It's contained in the engrossed version here in section 10. So that's.
Bill, will you speak your mind on this one?
How do you really feel about it? Not mince words here.
We really got, really went a long way with this section at all, in my view, but now to add the Class C felonies and, anyway, I guess you know how I feel. Everybody else likes it, well, I guess we'll adopt it.
No.
Mr. Chair,
yes, go ahead.
I guess I would pose a question. I'm sorry to interrupt. As I've thought about this, I would certainly defer to those who have tried a lot more cases than I have, but it seems to me that we're requiring basically two trials, and you're going to have a trial within a trial. And I'm just curious what discussion. I don't think we had a lot of discussion about on our side. I don't know if there was much discussion on the Senate side, but when you talk about proving the defendant must prove beyond a reasonable doubt the fact that the person was damaged or the person was engaged in conduct, I just don't know how you get around that.
I think
the way to do that is to require the state to make its case and prove that there's a conviction, and you require that there be a conviction.
Well, that's the way I do it. If I were the plaintiff's lawyer, I'd wait for the state to get through the prosecution. You'd have... res judicata, I think. I would assume if the state proves somebody's guilty beyond reasonable doubt, you turn around and file a lawsuit on that point, I suppose that would be res judicata. I don't know why it wouldn't be.
Do what now? What was that?
If the
don't have your phrase.
Law dictionary here, Representative Dix.
They used to give me a law dictionary, and now they took it away.
Well, okay.
Oh, there it is.
Well, you didn't get in trouble that way, Dick.
I hope I'm using it right.
That's right.
If the state proves
I'm not sure
the
on this one, that'll help you a lot.
Defendant. Okay. If the state proves the defendant was guilty of a Class A felony, then the defense in the civil case would say, well, that issue's already been tried, and there's been a finding by a jury that this person acted or committed a crime. So that establishes the fact that there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt that he was the plaintiff. Was engaged in erroneous conduct. So, if the plaintiff, let's see now, if the plaintiff who fell through the skylight in the schoolhouse sues the school district, the smart school district lawyer or the insurance company's lawyer representing the school district will wait until the state had successfully prosecuted this burglar from going through the skylight. And then when the burglar sued the school district because he had a broken neck, now that element would already be taken care of because it will have been adjudicated in a prior proceeding. I think that's how it would work, but you can see from this colloquy here that it's kind of a dumb rule, isn't it? And of course it's based on only one case in the entire history of the world. That's the green, that's the skylight case in California. Okay, but now you want to add Class C felonies. What, anything else? Okay, let's go on here. Wrongful use of a civil proceeding, looking at page 13. Now, if you want to prolong litigation, drive up the costs, increase insurance premiums, why vote for the de-engrossed version of this thing. So you have long drawn out counterclaims and counterclaims against counterclaims. And, you know, it's a beautiful way to get the best plaintiff's lawyer in town out of the case is you file in your answer. Now you name the plaintiff's lawyer along with the plaintiff and say that both the lawyer and the plaintiff brought this proceeding wrongfully and without just cause, and with no evidence, and with malice aforethought and everything else. Now what do you think? How can that plaintiff's lawyer ever proceed to represent his client in that case and try to claim it? Well, it's not possible to do it. He's a defendant now. The answer. See what I mean, John? On that? Plaintiff's lawyer becomes a defendant when the defendant in the first case files the answer, the counterclaim for malicious use or for wrongful use of civil process. I just don't know how that could possibly work. Maybe somebody can explain that. Paul,
I've been listening.
One of your sections. One thing if I might just in talking with both defense bar and plaintiff's bar attorneys, the 60 and the 30 days and 90 days I don't think is very workable, and I would suggest that I'm going to suggest at some point that we move, if we stay with D, that we, or if we go with C, whatever, that the 30 days and the 90 days be changed to 60 days and 120 days.
Duly noted, I guess. Can wait and discuss that, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm just putting it on the table, not...
I appreciate that.
1680.
I think you might have that marked in the lower version of your book.
Yeah, it's definitely in the lower version, too.
Yeah, 120 for the 90 days. 60 days for the 30 days.
Were you watching my comments on the monitor in there?
I was listening quite carefully.
I won't have to repeat it.
No, you don't have to. I think we disagree on that point, but I'm looking for some compromise language, to tell you the truth. But I feel quite strongly about that point, and perhaps as strongly as you do.
I should point out while we're here that in your books we put the on pages 13A and 13B. The material from the Oregon State Bar on frivolous actions and the section of the Washington statute that Senator Brennan handed out Friday.
I wonder if anybody's ever researched how that thing works in the state of Washington. I'm just curious to know whether it works.
Well, I don't, Eric, I don't have that other material that you just cited. Unless it's, perhaps I do. Right.
Fry, if you're willing to have this be a go-home bill sometime in July, I could research that for you.
Sometimes you have to take things.
Let's take a look at page 14. Now, what the House did on page 14, they took a perfectly wonderful bill, Senate Bill 222, and they stripped one of the three really good provisions out of it, stuck it in there as Section 12, and I don't have any argument with it. I don't mind it at all. Makes a lot of sense to me.
I don't believe there was any adverse debate of taking the one perfectly wonderful section out of the bill and sticking it into this one.
Can't help but wonder why there was one good section over the other, but anyway, I guess we can all agree on that pretty well, as far as I know. So on page 15, we've got an issue that all of us share concerns about, the problem of overindulging alcohol. We've all been participants in one way or the other in voting on bills the last three sessions on the subject of driving under the influence. So I suppose, or at least my thinking is colored to some extent by what the legislature's been doing in this area. Paul?
Yes, Senator.
You go ahead. Do you have? I tell you, I'm. What do you? How do you address the question of the intoxicated person who's had both the joint and a couple of slugs of whiskey and trying to differentiate? Or do you think that's even necessary to worry about in this situation?
Well, Senator, I. You know, we debated that the other day with regard to the people are licensed or permitted to provide alcohol, and that's what their liability should be subject to. There will be significant debate over this section, and I, at the request of the state police, will propose some amendments to Section 15 on page 15 dealing with the notification issue. Mm-hmm. And certainly willing to discuss the liquor liability issue. Clearly the number one priority for mine, for me, is Section 13 sub 3, the clear and convincing evidence issue, as you and I have discussed. Mm-hmm. The rest of it I feel quite strongly about, but I don't know how long we want to debate those issues.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think we're getting some amendments here, which I don't know if there are copies for everybody, but if I might be just allowed a moment to try to review with the committee what it is we're expecting of a person who's been injured in terms of what they have to prove, and what else we're going to ask them to prove. And I'm trying to think of the real-life situation here. We've got, more likely than not, your plaintiff is probably a person who's been injured in an automobile accident. That person may be gravely injured, may be hospitalized for a number of days, number of weeks, perhaps longer. The driver of the vehicle that caused the accident, almost by definition, is an individual who's intoxicated. And that person is probably facing criminal sanctions, quite aside from the civil action. Those criminal sanctions may not be imposed for many months. It may take months to get to a trial, whether the charge is DUII or whether the charge is more serious than that. That defendant, that driver who caused the injury, as long as that person is the subject of prosecution, it's going to be impossible or very, very difficult to get for the injured party or that injured party's attorney to get the police reports, because the DA's office and the police agencies generally, as a matter of policy, will not release any of the information or any of the reports while the prosecution is still pending. The plaintiff, the injured party, was not present in the establishment, again, many more times than not. Probably doesn't even know where that establishment was, doesn't know who was serving. I guess what I'm trying to say is that for the injured party, they've got a very, at least my impression and my sense is, they have a very, very, very tough time in terms of establishing the elements of their case and proving that by preponderance of the evidence even now. And I think the language in the House bill as presented makes it almost impossible, given the circumstances and the additional language here, in terms of requiring plaintiff to prove what just is impossible to prove based on where they're at in the circumstances that would give rise to this kind of action.
Paul, do you want to go ahead and explain what you have in mind on your amendment, why you're proposing that change?
Oh, certainly. The issue, when we first wrote Section 15, I think no.